Hi there, this is Brent.
And this is Amanda.
We are the Unreliable Narrators.
Here to talk about the strangeness, the mystery, and the wonder of Gene Wolfe's prose.
What is time?
What is memory?
What is a person?
Is this reality?
Where are we?
Do we exist?
Have you ever considered that all your choices were what brought you right here to this very moment?
Episode number 15, Bibliomen.
Well, Amanda, bibliomen.
Yeah, bibliomen. Men having to do with books.
Yeah. Before recording this podcast.
Okay.
Had this been a Wolfe work that you had read before?
No, I am reading it for the first time just for this recording.
Okay. I'm in the same boat. I was aware that it was a published Wolfe work. However, the price tag on the books had...
That had deterred you for a while?
Yeah.
Yeah, it deterred me as well. I spend an enormous amount of money on books much of the time, but these are fairly pricey publications. And speaking of which, we should probably review publication history. So I have down, first publication is Cheap Street Press, which put out a limited edition in 1984. And then it was republished in an expanded version by Broken Mirrors Press in October of 1995.
Yeah. And then the Broken Mirrors Press, they went under and the Small Beer Press ended up taking all their collection of Bibliomen and Crank magazine. And so at least at the time of this recording, you need to buy them through Small Beer Press.
Okay. That's how to get the current in-print edition.
Yes.
Okay.
There's also Cheap Street did two versions.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So there's the nice, I don't know if you want to talk about that.
Let's say there's the nice limited edition that we have sitting here that if this were a vlog instead of a podcast, you would get to see.
Yeah. So now you just have to deal with our limited descriptors.
I don't know how limited. I used to be a rare book dealer, so I could get a little convoluted here.
Okay.
It's lovely and half leather, brown half leather with paper covered boards. And a nice letterpress impression of book outlines on the cover. In papers are a nice brown that matches well with the covers. And then the text is printed on lovely deckle-edged paper. So it's a nice thick, heavyweight cotton paper and retains its nice rough edges. Definitely nice letterpress operation going on here because everything is deeply impressed in the paper, and so the words have texture if you are brave enough to touch them because you weren't the one that bought it and you can't quite remember how much it cost. Anyway, it's beautiful, absolutely beautifully done. The ink is all in very lovely brown tones. The fonts are very nice, and the arrangement on the page is just aesthetically pleasing, so I quite like it.
Yeah. What I got out of your description there is that Cheap Street is anything but cheap.
Yeah, pretty much. I think it's a nice ironic name for luxury printings of obscure things. I haven't seen anything else from them, but if this is at all representative, then it's pretty great.
Yeah. In addition to this one, there's also one that would be a little more hardbacky, like what most people would be thinking of when they think of a hardback.
Okay, so not the half leather.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I haven't seen that one. I've only seen one or two of them for sale.
Okay. Next to the Cheap Street edition, the Broken Mirrors Press edition does look a lot cheaper.
Well, yeah.
You know, purple, more graphic style cover, and just a slender little paperback. So, although it does have more material in it, so that maybe would be a plus for it.
Yeah, I was going to say there's two extra chapters or flash short stories in here.
Extra characters.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm afraid that the durability of the Cheap Street edition is definitely a mark in its favor. It may be a bit more expensive or quite a bit more expensive and not very available, even if you had the money to spend. But the little paperback is not going to hold up nearly as well as a nice sewn hard binding. So, yeah.
Well, we have a foreword, and then I think we'll do chapters 1 and 2. I'm not sure if to call it Bibliomen 1 and 2.
Yeah, characters 1 and 2. Subtitle, of course, is 20 characters waiting for a book. which is an evocative subtitle. Well, I want to talk about the dedication to the first book person I knew, Mary Ann Olivia Myers Wolf, who read to me when I was sick.
Oh, yeah, that's his mother.
Yeah, so there were two things about this that I really liked. One is that reading to your kid when you're sick is just, I mean, that's just good parenting. Although mostly my kids wanted to watch a TV show or something because I almost never allowed them to.
Yeah.
And so that was the treat when they were sick. But I love that image of her reading to him and that early exposure to books. And also, I just think it's a good, maybe just a good thing to be aware of. We read bibliomen, and then most, but not all, of the characters in bibliomen are male. Some of them are female. But here, the very first biblioman mentioned is, of course, a woman, which makes it very clear that however we would prefer language be used, and sometimes I would like to use more inclusive language that explicitly calls out that women are people too, because sometimes it seems like some people need to be reminded. Yeah,
that's
but a Dorothy
Sayers reference for listeners.
Yes, that very much was. That just, you know, for Wolf, at least, bibliomen clearly includes people who love books, all of us.
Yeah.
So the foreword.
Yeah, so he starts out with an Emily Dickinson quote, "There's no frigate like a book to take us lands away." So, and that's the first section of the Emily. There's more to the poem, but...
Yeah, and he points out that Emily didn't come out of her cabin very often, which I thought... Yeah, he also seems to think that she should have, or he would prefer to live a life where you're out of the cabin more because there are so many interesting people to find.
Yeah.
It's a good nautical metaphor as well. So very Wolfian.
Yeah. Something that comes up often. When I read that, one of the things I remembered was when I had first was reading about Emily Dickinson, and people would kind of go over to check on her because she was so reclusive that they thought she had died.
Right. Had to make sure that she wasn't... Yeah, decomposing in the spare bedroom.
Yeah. So the second section here has something I want to call out was...
Go for it.
"I've never met an author, a collector, a bookseller, an editor, or a habitual reader who is not an interesting person. Some have been detestable, none have been dull."
I actually have that quote marked out as well, and that struck me.
Yeah, I like how he follows that up where it's like, you can't fill a novel with these people.
Right. Book people have to interact with other people. Even in the context of a fictional story, you need to have some non-book people for them to interact with. But he likes creating these characters or likes finding or figuring out these kinds of characters, even though you couldn't fill all of the Book of the New Sun with bookish people.
Yeah.
Have you found that to be true in your experience, that book people are interesting people? I mean, we're not going to reconsider present company as a couple of book people. But in general, when you meet someone who is a book person.
In general, it does come with a caveat. Because
what's that caveat?
There are certain types of readers who don't discriminate between what they just consume. And a lot, so sometimes it gets difficult like interacting with them because they can't tell the difference between, oh, this is a Harlequin romance novel and this is Pride and Prejudice. It's the same.
Right. There are people who read a high volume of words but don't seem to engage with books in the way that you or I would find interesting.
Yeah. So, but generally, if you talk with them enough, there's something going on there.
Yeah. I would say my caveat would be not everyone who describes themselves as a book person fits into the category of what I would consider a book person. And maybe this is just me being extremely snobbish. But I had a strange experience one time where I met a man who in a sort of a generic social situation, and he was very excited because he'd heard that I liked to read and his favorite genre was science fiction and fantasy. And he wanted to talk to me about science fiction and fantasy. And again, awkward social situation. Yay, someone who wants to talk about books. But his big proposal for conversation was that we should each suggest to each other a book or books that the other might like to read.
Okay.
And
how'd that go?
Well, I wouldn't be telling the story if I didn't think it had gone hilariously. And I led with, I'm sure you could guess what I led with.
Gene Wolfe.
Gene Wolfe, yeah. I asked him if he'd ever heard of Gene Wolfe. He had never heard of Gene Wolfe. I suggested that he read The Book of the New Sun. I warned him that it was convoluted and a bit difficult to get into, but very rewarding because he described himself as a huge science fiction and fantasy nerd. I thought this was a good suggestion. He was enthusiastic hearing it. He sounded receptive. Okay. I have no idea if he's read it. Then the second and more frustrating half of the conversation ensued, and that took about 2 hours over tapas at a very nice restaurant in Las Vegas. I feel like I'm sharing too many details now. Anyway, in 2 hours, he could not suggest a book I hadn't read. And I admit I read a lot, but he led with Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451 and then went on to suggest books by Isaac Asimov, Heinlein. I can't even think of all of the authors that are just, you know, have you ever heard of Robert Jordan? Yes, I've heard of Robert Jordan. Have you, you like fantasy, right? Well, could I suggest George R. R. Martin to you? It's just, these are the bestsellers. They're on the tops of the list. They're on every bookstore's bookshelf. And anyway, he described himself as an avid reader. He probably was in some sense, but because he couldn't suggest a single book I hadn't read.
So are you suggesting that he's in the some have been detestable, but none have been dull category?
Well, actually, I would have classified him as dull and just not classified him as a book person.
Okay.
But not detestable. I think well-intentioned, just maybe not accustomed to talking to other people who also read a lot, because he was getting offended at one point.
Okay, that, I was going to say, it sounds like he's coming across a little bit mansplainy. I don't know if that's a word.
Well, I hesitated to go to that interpretation because it is a little bit easy, but it did kind of feel like, well, you've probably never heard of or read these very interesting books. And
yeah, with Ray Bradbury, like literally that book is read in a lot of high schools.
Yes.
Asimov is so famous that he has a magazine named after him.
Yes. And he's responsible for the publication of literally hundreds of books. Mm. So just statistically, you're going to encounter 1 or 1,000.
Yeah. George R. R. Martin. At the time, I'm assuming that
the TV show had started.
Okay.
So this is not early days.
Okay.
Yeah. So anyway, not everyone who considers themselves a book person would I consider a book person, but I do think on the whole, they're interesting people. I've met a lot of grumpy bookstore owners and I love every one of them.
Yes, I've had many experiences with grumpy bookstore owners.
Yeah, the ones that kind of are harumphing at you until you persist enough in browsing the shelves that then they'll be like, okay, I'll unlock the secret room full of valuable books.
So the idea here he has where he's putting all these characters looking for a book in there. I love this idea where it's like, well, these characters would be too much if they were all together.
Yes, we couldn't put them all in one story.
Yeah, I do have a note on when we get to chapter 2 about.
Okay.
I do think that the character shows up again later, but.
All right.
I don't know. It kind of seems like one of those things where it's like anybody's a writer. And it's like sometimes you have characters, but you don't necessarily have a story that you can write them in.
Yeah. And someone with as fertile an imagination as Wolfe's, it seems completely unsurprising to me that he would have 20 characters just sitting around waiting for the story that they could be in. And even these character sketches. And so that's one of the things I want to talk about is how these character sketches are hints at stories or the description of a character, but they do function as a self-contained story. They are whole stories, very limited in some way. They're not going to sustain a full short story or a long short story, much less a novel. As they exist, they're not that fleshed out. But in reading the character sketches, you do feel like you're in these little stories and that there's a whole world that exists there.
Yeah. And I think that we're seeing one of Wolfe's authorial traits here where you like just a light touch is suggestive of many details.
Yes.
And as counterintuitive as it may be, like these short pieces, they suggest like entire lives behind them. So,
right.
In that sense, I'm happy that I started reading these because this Like, it's one thing to sit down with, you know, like the solar cycle.
Yes.
And you get, it's like, okay, well, you know, 12 books. And it's like, okay, well, I feel like I know these characters. But then here, like some of these are like, you know, 2-3 pages. And yet I feel like the character is sketched out enough and there's enough like details that are evocative of life events and experiences that I could maybe like, oh yeah, I can recognize that character.
Right. And I could easily imagine a longer story that went into the building, the rising action, and the tension of these situations. And you could expand. Well, the first one, I don't know if we're ready to talk
about. I think we are.
Chapter one, Kirk Patterson, Arthur's PhD. I think you could write a novel about him, and it would be a really interesting novel. There's a whole story here. I could see 30 chapters about his life.
Yeah. I've been working on a spreadsheet where anytime Wolf references an author, references another work, you know, he's got a cover blurb, or I come across it, I've been writing it down.
Nerd.
Yeah, nerd. I actually paused here and I was like, oh, I better write these books down for looking up later.
Okay.
And so here we are in paragraph two of the story. His first work, Mask and Coin, Grub Street in the 30s. And then it was followed up by Maze of Gray, John Glaskin Revisited. And so it's like, oh, well, that's probably an actual author I should look up for.
And what did you find?
Well, I couldn't find anything on it because I had stopped and I should have just kept reading the story. So.
Yes. You thought you were actually tracking real things, much like the publishers of Kirk Patterson Arthur's thesis and later publications. So in summary, this is a character sketch of a guy who finishes graduate school in the mid-80s, gets a tenure track position, and then leaves academia after inheriting a fortune. And he then publishes a book admitting that he had faked a significant portion of his scholarship, including making up entire authors.
Uh-huh.
And then making up the works that he quoted from and had grounded his academic career on.
Yeah, so John Glaskin does
not a real author.
Not a real author, so.
Yeah, what's really interesting, though, is that he contextualized John Glaskin as a contemporary of Alroy Keir, also not a real author. In the context of the story, of course, or the character sketch, in the context of Wolf's story, you wouldn't know that both of these were fake, although you find out by the end of the character sketch, page two, that Glaskin is faked. But Alroy Keir is actually the name of an author made up by W. Somerset Maugham in a novel about authors.
Okay.
So Wolf used the name of a made-up author from Maugham's Cakes and Ale as the real author's name, the quote, real author's name. So we have layers of fakery going on here.
Yeah. In this, it reminds me of Borges. Borges will have footnotes in his short stories. Some of them, surprisingly, when you look them up, are actually legitimate footnotes.
Right.
And then other ones that look like they're totally legitimate, it's a fictional author.
It's all bullshit.
Yeah. Or it'll be a fictional piece, or sometimes it'll be a real author, but they didn't write the piece that they're... Or sometimes it'll say page, you know, whatever, 250, and the book only goes to 190. So it's... You know.
Well, this is why it's much more fun to be a fiction author than an academic author, because you can just make up the footnotes and the context. Oh, wait, I guess that's what we're doing right now. Talking about a character who made things up.
Yeah. I thought this section was kind of funny, but it like with the end there where there was like a little bit of an outcry, but then his works became collector works.
Right. Because he had had to push them into publication and
Yeah.
And there was resistance.
And now he's doing deep sea fishing and going to write a book on that.
I wonder if that will have footnotes. So there are a couple of things. One, I just wanted to point out the title of the first book, Mask and Coin. If only a mask and coin had ever appeared before in Wolf's fiction, maybe masks and coins are just so evocative, it doesn't matter. But there was a little part of me that wanted to create a context in the Wolf Extended Universe where mask and coin was a veiled reference to Severian.
If you argued it, I think I'm close enough to believing it would be true that I would probably believe it.
Okay, I'm not sure I'm arguing it, but if anybody has a justification, then they should go ahead and spell it out on Reddit or email me and I'll claim the ideas as my own. It also reminded me of the Sokol affair, which happened in the 90s. So after Wolf wrote this character sketch,
okay,
which timing wise frustrated me because I thought for sure when I first read this first chapter, I thought that he was making reference to a very famous situation where a physics professor faked a paper on the hermeneutics of physics and submitted it to a social sciences or a humanities magazine.
Okay.
And he titled it Transgressing the Boundaries Toward a Transformative Hermeneutics of Quantum Gravity, where he argued that quantum gravity has progressive political implications and that morphogenic field could be a valid theory of quantum gravity. And so he was making a point, which was that in the humanities, peer review was not very rigorous, and he had made the bold public statement that as long as you had cited the right philosophers or used the right jargon, you could probably get just about anything published in a humanities journal. And so then he just fed jargon into word salad and argued something completely nonsensical. And he got it published. It came out in a supposedly peer-reviewed journal, and nobody caught it. And then it was only weeks later he revealed that he'd made everything up in it. Mm-hmm. And all he had done is make sure that he footnoted the right philosophers that he thought were the trendy ones that would get it published. So that was what I thought Wolf might be playing with, but it was 10 years after this book was published. So,
Which makes you wonder how often it happens, but...
Yeah, because if you start to look into academic fakery, you find lots of things where people are fudging research numbers in hard science or soft science, but various scientific fields. But you don't find a lot of stories, or at least I couldn't find a lot of stories of people. I couldn't find a single story of somebody making up an entire author.
Yeah.
So you said it reminded you of Borges a little bit. I thought it also reminded me a little bit of Nabokov. And I know we're just now going down the list of known Wolf influences. But without a direct connection, just the flavor of it, the pseudo-academic titles, the fakery of it, reminded me of Nabokov's Pale Fire and the false interpretive effort of trying to impose meaning on something that wasn't there seems somehow, at least, to be connected to inventing a needed author whole cloth.
Well, that's about all I have for chapter one. Do you have anything else?
Oh, I just think Kirk Patterson Arthur's PhD would be fun to go fishing with.
Well, maybe.
But we're not going to be able to go fishing with Hopkins Dalhousie. I think that's how you would pronounce it.
I was going to ask you.
Oh, now. You're happy to have me say it first.
Yeah. Dalhousie. Yeah. Okay.
Dalhousie? I don't know.
Dalhousie?
Dalhousie?
Yeah.
Anyway, we'll just call him Hop. Yeah, so we're not going to be able to go fishing with him because, spoilers, he died.
Yeah. So chapter two, Hopkins Dalhousie. So this one, in one sense, it's kind of a found document in that it's not specifically about who it's titled after.
Yeah, this isn't a first person about Hopkins.
Yeah, it's about the AI in his car.
Yes.
That's being, I guess, interrogated, and I assume either by the police or it's on the stand, or we're not really given the context here, but it's the confession of 00028956.
Yeah, which is the AI that operates his $300,000 car.
Yeah. Wish we could buy a car for that cheap anymore.
Yeah, that'd be nice. So Hopkins apparently was a wealthy man, and he was able to afford a $300,000 car and a nice house and a lot of nice books. Mm-hmm. And then he ends up getting divorced and losing everything, including his income, and is reduced to selling off his possessions one by one. And the last thing he keeps is his AI-powered car, his AI-governed car. And he rides around in it and then he takes a final drive. And according to the car, at least, asks the car to run over him because he's done with life.
Yeah. And one thing, too, you said he lost everything. Reading this, it seemed to me like he lost his creative ability, too.
Yes, because it's not explicitly stated, or if it is, I'm oblivious. He seems to be an author character.
Yeah, that's kind of what I got out of it, that he was an author character. Because it talks about him sitting in the back and writing on the...
Yeah, the little fold-down desk.
Yeah, that yeah. is... His wife made fun of him for getting installed in there. The car's AI, it seems to be a combination of, it's kind of like a butler because it drives him around, but then also
right.
can like kind of talks with him. And so
yes. it kind of shows him trips that they will never get to take.
Yeah.
Uses his screen to show roads that he can no longer afford the fuel to go on.
Yeah. So it's kind of, it's kind of a Knight Rider like. Homage here with Kit, the car.
I'm going to pretend I understand that reference.
Oh, okay. And
I was thinking like the car version of Jeeves, the butler, but Knight Rider is, that's a comic, right?
Maybe it was, but I remember it was a TV show.
Oh, okay.
And so it was a car with an AI, but they kind of did crime fighting.
Okay, so I should just not make any comment on this because probably Wolf is influenced by what you're talking about.
Nah.
And I've never seen it, so I don't know.
I'm just trying to bolt it on to 80s pop culture references.
Okay.
So when he's selling off his books volume by volume, there's the now Proust?
Yeah, yeah. So 7 volumes of Proust?
Yeah.
I think is what it said. Yeah.
I get, as listeners have probably noticed by now, I'm not the best at pronouncing things correctly. So now I'm getting like a little self-conscious. I'm like, ooh, boy, is it really
more, well, it's a little bit
Proust?
It's a little bit weird because we live in a digital and connected age. So we ought to be comfortable pronouncing things because you can just check on stuff. But too often, you don't even realize you don't know how to pronounce something until it comes to the moment. So there's no way to be prepared ahead of time.
Yeah.
And we're both kind of in the same boat where, although, I mean, you went to school and then also to college. I didn't go to school as a child, but then I did go to college. So I've had some exposure to traditional education, and so have you. But there's just a whole universe of things that we've both read and learned only from books
yeah.
with no one else except, you know, sometimes each other to talk to about it, but we're equally ignorant about pronunciations.
Yep.
I'm pretty sure it's Proust.
Okay.
So
Proust is definitely an influence on Wolf. So
yeah, we are really running down the list today.
We are.
Borges, Nabokov, Proust.
Yeah. There is a section in here where, I mean, obviously this is the AI of the car talking, so I don't want to editorialize Wolf's politics too much, but there was government help enough for 1 million idlers, but not for Hopkins, who worked night and day and had once paid a fortune in taxes. I'm not sure if this is a, depending on how you read this, this could either be a argument for some sort of either patronage of the arts or a universal basic income, or at least just an acknowledgement that the way, at least in the US, we handle people who are in need, it's not the best.
Right. And so the contrast there with idlers, I think, could be a bit of a red herring toward you need a character test before you can get, you know, food stamps or welfare. But the way I read that was that Hopkins, if you look at his whole life, he's been a contributing member of society. And just because he's fallen on hard times now does not negate the fact that he was a contributing member of society before. And so whatever kind of social support system you should have, it should be able to consider the whole person and their full range of needs and yeah. also their full range of contributions. If he paid a bunch in taxes in the years where he was very successful, surely there should be some kind of safety net for him falling on hard times.
Yeah. I get annoyed with people's Reddit posts about Wolf's politics, and I don't think that they'll take something that a character says, not necessarily something that Wolf said in a like an interview or a nonfiction piece. And I don't feel like they harmonize everything together. And so here's a comment by obviously an AI character who is narrating the AI's version of the story because the title character of the chapter is dead. So,
well, I like how you also said harmonize because there are a lot of things that Wolf has explicitly said, and possibly some of these will come up in another context, where he explicitly said in an interview or wrote in a nonfiction piece that I don't think qualifies. He might have said something that sounds somewhat outrageous, but he might have been being provocative and not literally undersigning this. And if you think about any of us say somewhat outrageous things some of the time, but perhaps in context, we're saying it as a counterbalance to some other outrageous thing, or maybe we're saying it sarcastically and the transcript of the interview doesn't really capture the nature of his annoyance or frustration or the subtlety of expression. And so communication is more than just the flattest interpretation of speech. Basically, this is just an extended defense of anything ridiculous I have or will say, and I can backpedal at any time.
Well, but even along, like, you're allowed to change your mind too.
Oh, certainly.
Which Wolf said in interviews, like later interviews in his life, I've changed my opinion on this, or my thinking has shifted. So,
well, Wolf is allowed to change his mind, and I'm certainly glad I'm allowed to change my mind. I would not like to be responsible for defending 18-year-old Amanda's opinions on everything.
Yeah. So one of the next sections that I kind of wanted to talk about here is because we get to the point where he's sold or mortgaged everything. And we get to the point where at last a man from the bank came and explained that he would have to give me up unless his debt was paid by the end of the month. He had mortgaged me and it was already the 27th. So I think in one sense of looking for motive here, people always like to tease apart like extra stories in the back. So maybe we have two stories going on here. We have the writer, or at least the guy that was right before that, he worked in Me Too, writing on that little folding shelf in the back that his wife had said he'd never use. I think that's where I kind of got it in my mind that he was a writer. I don't necessarily know if that's the case, but.
So we have two stories, Hopkins, the writer, and
the AI's either interpretation or re-narration of the events, like however.
Right.
So, but they go out in the hills on a drive. I did not have enough fuel to get back. So it sounds like Hopkins kind of knew that he was walking out into the desert.
Yeah, so it was time.
Yeah, it was time. So he gets out there, and then the way that it's set up too is because Hopkins goes downhill and like looks back
at the car,
and it seems like the car has some sort of safety features so it won't hit a person. So where it's set up to go downhill, the car knows that Hopkins wants to end his life.
Right, because momentum will take over even though the car can't swerve into him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it ends with, it's like, you know what I want is what the AI's interpretation of his...
of Hopkins' facial expression.
Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, here we have a machine with some kind of sentience and some kind of will and choice, although it's constrained by its programming.
Yeah. But at the same time, too, we get the AI appears to be interpreting his emotional state. But then not only that, but in a small sense, maybe larger, but at least in a small sense, they're participating in a creative act where they're imagining, oh, these were the drives that were going to go on. And I don't know if I'm warranted in like imagining this in my own mind, but I'm imagining that the windows also serve as like screens. So the car is projecting like a simulation of them driving. And so they're both participating in the shared creative act. And so while the AI is constrained by its programming, it also seems to have more of a personality than like necessarily like what we would be imagining. I'm thinking of the dumb little chat bots that are always like, hey, do you need help on this webpage?
And yeah, the Clippy and all of Clippy's descendants.
Yeah.
I think more of a personality. You were saying more of a personality than we're imagining. And I was thinking more of a personality than some people I've met. But I guess that's, I don't know, three counts for snobbishness against me today.
Three recorded. Yeah. So the tires land on him.
Yeah. And he holds still until he can no longer cry out.
Uh-huh.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. The doctors might have saved his life. We might still have his broken wreck. I do like that there, where it's like a broken wreck. We look at that and it's like, oh, yeah, it's like his life. Like I've heard people describe people's decisions like, oh, yeah, broken wreck. But then it's like, well, you have an AI that sensory inputs a vehicle, a car. So, and it's
broken wreck is working on that level as well.
Yeah. So it's like kind of a dual, like a literal and figurative there. Like,
yes.
So, yeah, that's the way I would want to go. But
yeah, I don't know if that's the way I would want to go either. But if I had to sell all the books, I suppose, you know, there'd be worse things like living bookless.
Yeah.
This guy, Hopkins, seems less obviously a biblioman than Arthur's, because you kind of have to tease out that he's an author, or, you know, we're making at least a little bit of an interpretive leap. It's a small step, not really a jump to conclusions here, but it's also, other than the mention of the books in the trunk, there's not a lot of bookishness named in the story.
No, but I definitely interpret him as an author. That's what
I think. That's reasonable.
Yeah. Which I don't. I mean, I've had to offload books several times in my life.
Me too.
And it's not an easy thing. And or at least for me, it's not. And I still think about like, oh, I shouldn't have got rid of that book. And
oh, yeah, I have particular books in my mind. I can see them. I had to sell one time or another to pay for one thing or another.
Yeah. I can see where if he was depressed and then he's having to sell off his library, his own collection, it's like,
right.
Yeah, definitely can. Because we get the indication that he paid a lot in taxes, which I'm extrapolating to he was making a lot of money. Mm-hmm. But then when he's down on his luck and he's, I don't know if he's lost his job or he's not getting contracts, writing his books, or maybe mm-hmm. they're not as popular as they used to be. And then he's getting divorced, and then he's mm-hmm. losing his home and all his possessions, and then his books, which, you know.
Well, that would just further hamstring your creative life if you don't have your books.
Yeah. So I don't know if we're supposed to question whether or not the AI planned this out and was like, oh, I don't want to be sold. Like, I want you to own me, or like what? I don't know. They seem to have not a person-object relationship.
Right. They have a friendship of some kind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
And the AI is admitting that, like, yeah, if, so be it if you decide that I need to be dismantled, but, you know.
I accept the consequences of my decisions, but.
Yeah. So it seems like the AI, there was forethought that went in. It's like, oh, this is what he's asking me to do, and this is what may be the consequences, so.
Yeah.
So I had mentioned that in chapter two, I thought this one was a character that came back.
Yeah, that came back in another story.
Yeah. So actually, I think the AI, or at least that some version of the AI, comes back in The Borrowed Man.
Oh, interesting.
And then Interlibrary Loan actually is the one I'm thinking about, because there's the boats. They go and they interact with the boats, and it says that they charter a boat. And then, you know, a few chapters in, then you realize, oh, when they're talking about chartering the boat, they're actually talking to the boat. And so the boat is the one negotiating, like, the contract and everything. And then it appears to be some sort of, the boat has an AI. There seems to be an AI on there. And so it's taking them out and making decisions and refueling and buying supplies in the different ports. So
I would say the only quibble I would have with that is I think that, at least in the context of Wolf's fiction, AI is the way we talk about sentient machines. Mm. But Wolf, I don't know, we've been talking about AI because that in the context of the story, that's what it is. But in so many of his stories, you have a sentient machine. And in the story, in the universe of the story, they're spoken of as persons. Yeah. Not spoken of as artificial anything. So yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I just went back to an earlier episode mentally and thought about Rattler, which is the haunted truck.
Well, yeah.
Or the truck possessed by the spirit of the dog, the tall tale that Wolf co-authored with whatever his name was. I can't think of it right now. But I was like, oh, okay, so we have another sentient vehicle, but obviously a completely different scenario and situation and different causality here.
Yeah.
So.
Well, do you have anything else that you'd like to bring up about these? I think I'm done with.
I think that's about all I have. I mean, for 5 pages of text, I think that was probably pretty good. I do like these stories. I'm looking forward to finishing out the rest of the book because this whole conceit of bookish characters, bibliomen, it's one that I just very much enjoy.
Yeah. No, I'm glad we bought the book and are reading through it.
Me too. All right. Well, the unreliable narrators are Amanda Patchen and Brent Towle. And as Jean Wolfe said, all novels are fantasies. Some are more honest about it.